Ask many of us to name a famous philosopher, and the names come pretty quickly, especially the ancient Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. Now name practical applications for philosophy. That list might come a little slower, which is among the many reasons why today's guest wrote his book. Jules Evans is a journalist and writer who teaches and blogs about practical applications for philosophy. He helps run the London Philosophy Club and is policy director for the Center for the History of Emotions. And he's the author of Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations, Ancient Philosophy for Modern Problems, now out in paperback. Jules Evans, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
It's very good to have you. The Center for the History of Emotions, that's a fascinating name. What is that?
It is a there's a new movement within academic history to look at the history not just of countries or economies, but also at kind of a more intimate history, so history of emotions, a history of things like jealousy or love or anger. The idea is, I guess, that our emotions are not just physical and biological phenomena, but they're also mediated through our beliefs and through our culture. So our experience of, say, something like love or anger or jealousy changes over time in different kind of cultural connotations. So there are people who write about that and look into that and try to discover, when we talk about happiness now, for example, do we mean the same thing that Jefferson talked about when he talked about the pursuit of happiness? So has our understanding of, you know, has how we grieve changed over time, for example?
Oh, it's interesting. So if we know a little more about the way that people viewed the emotions of the time, we can certainly understand the context of the times and the emotions within that context a whole lot better.
And also how things have changed, perhaps how, you know, how our own emotions have changed and how our beliefs and culture shape how we feel today.
So, Jules, what career track were you on when you latched on to philosophy?
I was at university, and it kind of afterwards that I got into it. So I basically came to it out of necessity. I was in a kind of life crisis. When I was a teenager, my friends and I did quite a lot of drugs. We were quite into kind of experimenting with drugs. And things like LSD and magic mushrooms and stuff, inspired a lot by kind of California in the 1960s, I'd say. And so we had some kind of fun experimentations, but then we managed to like mess ourselves up a bit. So by the time I was 19 and in my first year at university, I started to get panic attacks and kind of mood swings and depression and social anxiety. And basically my emotional life went down the drain, which was a bit of a kind of a shock to me, to the 19-year-old me. And so all the way through university, I was really trying to understand what was going on with my emotions. Why had they gone so violently wrong? And what could I do about it? And I was quite terrified that I might have done some permanent damage to myself and that maybe there was nothing I could do about it. And then basically, after university, I finally went, my parents sent me to see a therapist, and he diagnosed me as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and depression and social anxiety. And he wasn't able to help me, but I looked up those conditions for myself on the internet and found they could be helped by something called CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a very kind of scientifically credible form of therapy. So I did a course of CBT, and that helped me a lot and kind of basically stopped me having panic attacks and taught me to understand how I could transform my emotions. And I became fascinated in that therapy, CBT, and I went to interview the guy who invented it, Albert Ellis, who was an American psychologist. And I asked him, where had he got the idea for CBT from? Where had this great therapy, which had basically saved my life, come from? And he told me he'd been inspired by ancient philosophy, which was a big surprise to me, because I thought of philosophy as something very academic and theoretical and impractical, and not something that could really save lives, but it turned out that it can.
Are you convinced that was the drugs? I mean, and not something that just happens to people when they begin to move away from home and get off into their own world
Maybe.
By themselves?
I think I was probably, you know, I was very happy for the first kind of 18, 19 years of my life, but I probably was quite a sensitive and thoughtful young man. And so probably not the kind of person who should do lots of LSD. I think we kind of, you know, I had basically a couple of bad trips on LSD, and which were kind of really terrifying. And then I, because I, you know, I, in a stupid English way, didn't really talk about it to anyone. I kind of like buried it and didn't want to show any weakness to other people. And I think that made it a lot worse. So I think it was a combination of the kind of rather traumatic experiences and then stupidly not really telling anyone about it, not telling my parents, not telling my friends, only my poor, long-suffering girlfriend who kind of had to kind of put up with it. So I think, yeah, I think the drugs were the trigger, really.
All right, much more to talk about with Jules Evans. His book is Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations. We'll talk more with Jules and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jules Evans. He is a writer and journalist who blogs and teaches and writes about practical applications for philosophy. His book, now out in paperback, is Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations, subtitled Ancient Philosophy for Modern Problems. Join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you've applied philosophy to problems in your own life in today's world. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Jules, you were saying you got into philosophy via the pathway of cognitive behavioral therapy to try to get yourself back on track when you were getting a little wobbly here. CBT and its relationship to philosophy, how strong a relationship is that?
So CBT was pioneered by two psychologists in the late 50s and 1960s, two American psychologists called Albert Ellis and Aaron Beck, both of whom I interviewed. And they both told me that they were directly inspired by Greek philosophy, and particularly this idea, which is very strong in the Stoics, in Stoic philosophy, which is that, to quote Epictetus, this Stoic philosopher, men are disturbed not by events, but by their opinion about events. So that basically inspired the kind of cognitive theory of the emotions, which is the idea that our emotions involve beliefs or judgments about the world, and that we can transform our emotions by changing our beliefs, changing how we see a situation.
So the concept and layout of the book, based essentially on a painting, as you point out, tell us about the School of Athens.
Mm-hmm. School of Athens is a painting by Raphael, the Italian Renaissance painter, and it's a beautiful painting of a kind of imagined city scene with various of the great minds of the ancient world hanging out together and having a kind of conversation or debate. So you've got Plato and Aristotle in the center, Plato pointing up at the heavens, Aristotle pointing down at the ground to show their different approaches to life. Socrates is there, Heraclitus, Diogenes the Cynic is kind of sprawled out on the steps, Pythagoras is there. And basically that kind of, when I saw that, I imagined what would it be like to go to that, to engage in that conversation. What would it be like if there was a dream school with all those amazing teachers there, teaching us not just abstract theories, but teaching us how to live well? So I just, in the book, I imagine going to that dream school, getting a kind of free pass to go there. And each of the chapters is a different ancient philosopher teaching us something that we can use in our life. So Socrates starts off by teaching us the art of asking questions. Epictetus, this philosopher I mentioned already, talks about the art of maintaining control. Seneca teaches the art of managing your expectations. So it's really trying to return to the ancient Greek and Roman idea that philosophy is not just a theory, but at its best it can be a way of life and also a therapy for the emotions. Socrates said that he teaches his students how to take care of their souls, which is where the word psychotherapy comes from. It literally means care of the soul. So I wanted to kind of revive that idea of philosophy as a kind of very practical therapy for our emotions and something that helps us to live well. And I also wanted to show in my book, I wanted to tell the story of people in modern life who'd used philosophy like I had to kind of to get through difficult times. Because over the last over the 5 years while I was writing this book, I came across lots of other people of all different walks of life who'd also just come across Greek and Roman philosophy and found it a complete lifesaver.
And Socrates himself, as you point out in the book, appeared to be one of the people who thought in terms of practical daily applications for philosophy. How?
Yeah, of course. I mean, he was pre-academic philosophy. There wasn't any such thing as academic philosophy. I mean, he thought that philosophy can teach us to take care of our souls and to discover the secret of happiness. For him, the secret of happiness was not to look to externals, to things like wealth or power or status, but to look within, to try and develop your virtue, to develop your soul so that you do the right thing, and that, you know, the wise man can find happiness just in that, in doing the right thing, in doing the virtuous thing. And he was very much a kind of street philosopher. He would, you know, wander around Athens, engaging his fellow Athenians in conversation, saying, hey, where are you rushing off to? What are you doing with the day? What do you think is the most important thing in life? In order to get them to kind of examine their unconscious or unexamined life philosophy and hold it up to the light and say, is this really a good philosophy for life? Is this wise? Are there other ways that I could live?
Cognitive reappraisal is a term you bring up in the book. How new or old a concept, and what does it mean?
Cognitive reappraisal is just, so often we will have a kind of instinctive reaction to an event. Let's say we're walking down the street and we pass someone who's frowning, and we kind of immediately feel insulted or offended. And that's just because we made a snap judgment about that event. We probably thought, that person is frowning at me. They're looking down at me in some way. They're kind of making a negative judgment of me. And we're also perhaps thinking something like, and they shouldn't. How rude. What a rude person. And that kind of snap judgment leads to us feeling angry or offended or insulted. But according to the Greeks and according to CBT as well, we can kind of catch ourselves doing that and say to ourselves, is that definitely true or wise? Is that the right way to look at that situation? And then we might decide to reappraise it, to look at it a different way. So we might say to ourselves, well, was that person definitely frowning at me? Perhaps they were just frowning. Perhaps that's just their kind of, you know, normal expression. Or if we know that they were frowning at me, do we have to get angry about it? Do we have to feel insulted and offended for the rest of the day? Perhaps we can just shrug and say, well, so what? No big deal. So what you can do in real time, I'm sure your listeners will have had experience of this, and perhaps you will as well, you can just change your perspective on things, and that will change how you feel. So we have this kind of real-time ability to modulate our emotions by choosing the perspective we take on things.
Which is essentially remapping our impressions of it and telling our brain, no, don't think of it that way, think of it this way, which gets into an area that you're not the first person to talk about in this program, but plasticity in the brain.
That's right. But I think plasticity is a really important point, because the idea of plasticity is that we do have very ingrained habits which will kind of prod us to look at things in a certain way. If we've every day thought that, you know, our life is a disaster and we're a complete loser, we're very likely to think that tomorrow as well. So what that means is it's not enough just to look at things differently once. We have to kind of do it repeatedly and build up a new habit. And I think the Greeks were great at that. They understood the importance of habits to changing ourselves. You know, it's not enough just to have a moment of epiphany or moment of insight. We have to kind of rehearse and practice and repeat ideas over and over until they become ingrained habits. And we also have to practice in real life situations as well. This philosopher Epictetus, who I've mentioned already, he said, we may be very good at philosophy in the classroom, but take us out into the street and we're miserably shipwrecked. So we also have to practice our philosophy in real life situations as well. So, for example, when I had social anxiety, I could challenge my socially anxious beliefs in the safety of this self-help group that I went along to, which helped me a lot. But that wasn't enough. I also needed to practice in real-life situations, which meant, you know, going to parties when I really didn't feel like going to parties, when I felt very shy and introverted, and practicing just kind of standing up to that fear and doing the opposite. So I think habits of thinking and behavior are very important as well.
Jules Evans is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations, Ancient Philosophy for Modern Problems, making practical applications of the philosophy of the ancients right up to the modern day. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your own perceptions of places that philosophy might have helped you in daily life. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So this is a bit of a push, it sounds like. You're not the only person involved in the process of thinking about more practical applications mm-hmm. for daily philosophy. And you introduce us to the concept of PIPs. What are those?
That stands for Philosophy in Pubs. So it was a movement launched in Liverpool, you know, where the Beatles are from, and it was launched by an unemployed bricklayer. And he, you know, he didn't have a job, and he went along and did a philosophy course to keep himself busy. And he completely fell in love with philosophy and thought, you know, particularly the ancient Greeks and Romans, and thought this is an incredible tradition within our culture. And he couldn't believe that no one had told him about this already, because it seemed such valuable kind of wisdom. And he wanted to change the culture in his neighborhood and reintroduce philosophy to ordinary people. So he launched this movement called Philosophy in Pubs, which just kind of gets people together to discuss different philosophical ideas in pubs. And there are now 15 of these PIP groups just in Liverpool alone. And they're also all over the country as well. There's about 50 of these PIP groups across Britain. And there are similar kinds of grassroots philosophy movements all over the world. I think in the U.S. there's a whole movement called Socrates Cafes, which was started by an American philosopher, and they meet in pubs and libraries and community centers and just kind of talk over philosophical ideas, and really just for the pleasure of it, really, and also to kind of try and, I guess, improve their lives as well.
So let's talk more specifically about the applications then, because the morning session in the School of Athens, as you imagine in the layout of the book, mm-hmm. is about the warriors of virtue, and you start off talking about one of the more dire situations in which you'd need to understand what you do and do not have control over, which is in military applications. Mm. But I was surprised to find that it's not just theoretical. You're talking about the U.S. military actually embracing some of this.
Yeah, there's a long tradition of the U.S. Armed Forces looking to ancient philosophy for kind of advice on how to build strong characters and how to build resilient warriors. So one of the most famous examples of this was a gentleman called Vice Admiral James Stockdale, who in the Vietnam War, he was captured and was a prisoner of war. And he was tortured repeatedly. He was kept in confinement for 7 years, incredibly tough situation. And he says what got him through was someone had happened to lend him a book by this Stoic philosopher Epictetus. And he'd actually memorized this book before he was, captured. And he says that the wisdom of Epictetus really got him through that very, potentially very traumatic situation. And particularly the wisdom, the idea of Epictetus, as he said he found particularly helpful, was the idea of knowing the difference between what you control in a situation and what you don't. So obviously, in a prisoner of war situation, there's so much about your situation you don't control. And if you focus on that, if you focus on all the things that are out of your control, you're going to feel very powerless and traumatized and at the mercy of your captors. And yet what Epictetus said and what James Stockdale discovered was true was that there are always some things that your captors don't control. They don't control your own beliefs, your own perspective, your own thoughts. That kind of sphere of inner freedom is always your own if you kind of choose to exert your autonomy in that. So Stockdale used that idea really to kind of preserve his inner freedom and to not let his Vietnamese captors break him. And he wasn't kind of, he actually used his captivity as an opportunity to assert his moral freedom and his autonomy. And he eventually, you know, was released and rose up the ranks and became vice admiral in the U.S. Navy. And, you know, now the U.S. Navy gives an Epictetus Award every year for courage and bravery. And there's also a center in San Diego called the SEER Center, which stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. And it's actually called the Stockdale Center. and they teach some of these ideas that Stockdale found so useful to every soldier in the army to try and learn how to cope if you're captured by enemy forces. And there are many other ways that that the U.S. Armed Forces is influenced by ancient philosophy, particularly by Stoicism. And in my book, I talk to several soldiers who just, you know, say that they use ancient philosophy as a kind of way of life, and they've used it in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in some very kind of tough situations.
How would you define Stoicism then? Is it something like calm in the face of things that would normally not keep you very calm?
Yeah. Stoicism, in some ways you could compare it to Buddhism. So it's partly about being mindful, being aware of how your thoughts create your emotions, and learning to be intelligent or skillful in your thoughts and in your beliefs. And more broadly, it's learning that we don't have that much, you know, we don't have complete control over the outside world, that the outside world is a kind of constantly changing place. And it's a place where, you know, often things will you know, bad things can happen. But we do have control over our own thoughts, our own attitude. And that gives us the ability to adapt, to kind of roll with the changes. And to, you know, so the Stoics say, look, you've got to accept the limit of your control over the outside world. You know, bad things sometimes might happen. But you can always, you know, find your good in doing the right thing. You always have a choice over how you think, over how you behave. So if you find your good in doing the right thing, then you can pursue a good life no matter what's happening in the outside world. Even if you're in a, you know, a prisoner of war, for example, in the worst kind of situations, you can still do the right thing.
All right, that explains the heading that threw me at first, Stoic optimism, where the fact is the optimism comes from knowing that you do have some control over yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the ancient Stoics also, I mean, we should say that they believed in God as well. They thought of God, they called God the Logos, and they believed in it as a kind of divine intelligence which, you know, fills all things, which kind of permeates the universe. And they thought that everything happens, ultimately happens in accordance with this Logos. So really, you know, we have to try and take a kind of cosmic perspective on things. And if something happens to us which seems to us bad, we have to say to ourselves, well, that's, you know, part of the will of God, part of the will of the Logos, so we should accept it. You could compare that to Taoism, I suppose, the idea of that, you know, that the Tao is constantly changing, but the wise man or the wise woman can learn to live in accordance with the Tao. So it's a similar idea in Stoicism, that the wise man or the wise woman can learn to live in accordance with the Logos.
Let us take a call. Here's Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jules Evans. His book is Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. Very interesting. One of the things I wanted to add was I was very fortunate when I was a teenager at my high school that we had a person come from one of the universities nearby and speak to us about philosophy, and we started a philosophy club. Mm-hmm. And I think especially with teenage minds and with people in college, it was so important. Everybody was, you know, thinking about the unexamined life and, you know, is not worth living and all that. And this was in the 60s. And it gave people an idea of a method of thought, a way of thinking, a methodology, whether it's logic or whatever. And I found that so helpful then and among the people I was with. And I also took, we had mandatory philosophy classes in my small college I went to as well, so that all the science people and everyone had to take philosophy together. And those, I think, do lead to the unexamined, you know, the idea that you can examine every situation. And I find myself, as you say, walking down the street, and I say something to myself about something, and I say, what are you thinking? You know, why did you say that? And
right.
So the being able to have the simple tools or the mental preparedness to be able to look at something from a quote, philosophical perspective really, really helps you understand yourself, and I think lead a better life with other persons as well.
All right, Connie, thanks for that. Any response, Jules?
Well, I mean, I completely agree. Connie was talking a bit about the kind of philosophy for children movement there, which was started in the 60s by this great American philosopher. I think his name was Matthew Lipman. And he thought you've got to start young and give young, you know, children the ability to think critically and reasonably. And it's been an incredibly successful movement and is still very influential in the UK as well.
We have a lot more to talk about with Jules Evans. His book is Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations. We welcome your phone calls and emails. We'll take those as we return to the Jefferson Exchange with Jules Evans in a minute and 5 seconds. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Jules Evans. He is the author of a book called Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations, Ancient Philosophy for Modern Problems, now out in paperback. It's arranged, its table of contents, and its chapter organization like a day at the School of Athens, the morning session, the Warriors of Virtue, and we're now up to lunch, the Philosophy Buffet. We'll get into that in just a moment. Let me remind you the phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. So now we get to lunch and we meet Epicurus. His name itself hints at what he brings to the table, but it's more than just food, you explain, Jules.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Epicurus basically thought that the aim of life is to be happy here on Earth. He thought that we only have one life. When we die, he was an atomist, so he thought when we die, our atoms just return to become part of the cosmos. But we are blessed with reason, which gives us the ability to use our you know to learn to be happier through wisdom. And a lot of our problems, he thought, a lot of our suffering is self-inflicted through our beliefs, through our foolish attitudes, through kind of inflating our needs with unnecessary desires, through desire for luxury or status or power or things like that, things which aren't really worth the stress. So he thought if we learn to live simply and wisely, we can be perfectly happy with this one life that we've been given.
Which then tends to run counter to, I think, the way a lot of people think about Epicurus, which is to really indulge in life's pleasures and a more hedonistic kind of thing. But he was more to the ascetic side from the sounds of it.
Yeah, I mean, so it's funny how these words have changed over time. So now Stoic means stiff upper lip, you know, someone who just represses their emotions, which isn't what the Stoics were like at all. They actually, you know, really understood the emotions and were all about transforming the emotions. And likewise, Epicurean now means, as you say, a kind of glutton or a libertine. And Epicurus wasn't like that. He said, you know, you can get by with just some bread, olives, and water, and if it's a really special day, perhaps a bit of cheese.
There's an interesting group you mentioned here, Action for Happiness. It's actually more of a movement than a group. Tell us about that.
Action for Happiness are a movement started by some kind of politicians and some teachers in the UK. And they think, like Epicurus, they think the aim of life should just be like happiness here on Earth. They don't believe in an afterlife. And they think that we can use the kind of wisdom of ancient philosophy as well as the new research from psychology to learn how to be happier. So they're very influenced by this new movement called positive psychology. Well, actually, it's not that new. It's been around for about 15 years now. Which takes some of these ideas from Greek philosophy and from CBT, but says, you know, like CBT is mainly used by people who have emotional problems, things like depression or anxiety, and it helps them to get better, and it's very scientifically credible. And positive psychology says, why don't we use these same techniques for everyone, not just to overcome depression, but to achieve happiness or flourishing? So Action for Happiness is trying to spread some of these ideas from ancient philosophy and from modern psychology and to kind of spread them to the ordinary man and woman. And they also want to, they're trying to start up Action for Happiness groups and to kind of teach happiness in schools and these kinds of things.
I was aware of some smaller countries like Bhutan, primarily, that have moved to this gross national happiness index or something like that, but didn't realize that the Action for Happiness people have convinced the UK to measure national happiness. Now, what are the measures they use, though?
Well, they use pretty straightforward measures, Jeffrey. I mean, they just ask people, how happy are you at the moment on a scale of 1 to 10, and how satisfied are you with your life are you on a scale of 1 to 10, and then they kind of plot that over time. And And, you know, I think there's a movement, there's interest in trying to do this in America as well. So Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, has expressed interest in this kind of thing. And Jeffrey Sachs, one of the, you know, most famous American economists, also thinks that, you know, well-being measurements should be introduced. And, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical because it just seems a rather blunt measuring tool, saying to someone, well, how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10? It assumes that happiness is just one thing and that you can put a number on it. I think perhaps there are various different types of happiness or flourishing, and not all of them can be measured. So Aristotle, for example, he thought flourishing meant not just feeling good, but also you know, being virtuous or doing something meaningful with your life. And I'm not sure you can measure how meaningful a person's life is from 1 to 10.
So we move on after lunch at the School of Athens to the mystics and the skeptics and a story of astronaut Edgar Mitchell. He experienced something that that he called the big picture effect, or at least you call it that. What happened to him, and what's the effect? What's the name for this in philosophy?
So Edgar Mitchell was on one of the first Apollo flights. I think he was the seventh man in space. I'm not quite sure of that, but he was very early in the kind of the golden age of space exploration. And on the way back of this Apollo flight, he was looking out of the window at the Earth and at the Moon and at space, and he had a sudden moment of expansion, I guess you could say, of consciousness expansion, and felt suddenly that he was connected to the entire cosmos and that we all are somehow kind of connected to the cosmos. And when he came back to, when the shuttle landed, he kind of tried to research what had happened to him, and he was kind of fascinated by it, and he decided that this was something that had happened to lots of people, and he called it the big picture effect, that suddenly you get a sudden expansion of your view, you suddenly attain to a kind of cosmic view, and this can be a very transformative event. And for him it was completely transformative. It really changed him, and he became, in his own words, a kind of peacenik who is trying to develop, you know, trying to improve relations between different kind of countries and people. And in philosophy, this relates, the ancient Greeks and Romans had this idea that we can also try and cultivate this kind of big picture effect. We should try and take a cosmic view on things. So if we find ourselves getting very worked up over something that's happened to us in a day or over something in our life, we can learn to kind of broaden our perspective. And they would do this as a kind of visualization exercise. Imagine themselves, you know, viewing their life from the perspective of space, taking kind of cosmic perspective in order to make a molehill out of a mountain, you could say. So for them, astrophysics and astronomy was almost a kind of form of therapy, a way of stilling the soul and giving it a sense of awe and wonder.
Let us take some calls. We have first Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jules Evans. His book is Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Jules. Let's see. Well, first of all, personally speaking, I always use this as kind of a mantra that whenever bad things happen or things that I think are bad happen, I always think to myself, it could always be worse. Mm-hmm. So I kind of put it in a perspective of that way. Let's see. Jules, Epictetus said that the first business of a philosopher is to part with self-conceit, mm-hmm. and I think that this kind of connects with the Alcoholics Anonymous' serenity prayer, which it says pretty much, to paraphrase it, that God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, mm. the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to tell the difference. And well, I just thought I would throw those things out there, and mm. I believe they kind of interconnect with what you your books are about. And congratulations that you got one in paperback, because that's usually a good sign of success, because usually they only go as far as hardcover. And Jeffrey, I'll take the comments from the guest off the air.
All right, thanks, Jamie. Appreciate it. And in fact, the Serenity Prayer is mentioned and repeated here in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that that caller just had Epictetus at his fingertips. He had the kind of wisdom of Epictetus. He'd obviously absorbed it and digested it. And that's, I mean, I meet people like that all the time who just have come across these ideas and found them really useful in a kind of day-to-day way. It's not just academics. Academics can be very snobbish and think the only people who really are into philosophy is them. Actually, not at all. I think, you know, I've met people who are far more, you know, who really live their philosophy through various, very difficult situations and through very challenging life situations. And I'm more impressed with them than I am with, you know, some academic philosopher who can just talk the talk but has never really been challenged.
Another call is Dennis and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jules Evans.
Yeah, say, my daughter-in-law is a psychiatrist. She works for the RAND Corporation. Mm. And they've been using cognitive theory. In fact, she's the lead research person down there for about 15 years for dealing with people who have post-traumatic stress syndrome, alcoholism, drug problems, anxiety problems. And I just wondered if the guest is aware that they are involved in that sort of thing.
Mm.
All right. Thanks, Dennis.
I didn't know that the RAND Corporation used cognitive therapy. That's fascinating. I mean, the two big things that I write about in the book are, firstly, in the UK, in my country, the government has put £500 million into making CBT free on our National Health Service. And they've trained like 6,000 therapists in CBT to give kind of short-term therapy. I'm talking about like about 8 sessions of it and stuff, which helps about 50% of people to get better from depression and anxiety. So I think that's great. It's, you know, that my government's taking it seriously, taking these things like depression and anxiety seriously, because it costs our economy billions in sick days, and not to mention just the human suffering involved. And there are these ideas that are very kind of practical, very common sense, which can really help people to learn to kind of heal themselves, to be the doctors to themselves, as a Roman philosopher called Cicero put it. And the second thing I write about in the book, the other kind of big initiative, is the U.S. Army has a big program called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, and they put about $200 million into it to teach basic kind of resilient thinking techniques to every soldier in the U.S. Army and also to their families. And that comes also from CBT, and, you know, it comes back to this idea in ancient philosophy that you can't always control what happens to you, but you can control the perspective you take on it. So the U.S. Army has kind of put a lot of money into that to try and reduce the rates of post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans.
Let's take another call from Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jules Evans.
Good morning. Mr. Evans, do you have any knowledge of what has been recently touted as the holographic brain put forward by Carl Priebum out of Stanford, and how that holographic brain may touch upon your philosophy? And if you have heard of it, and if you can expand upon it, has the military, these fine people from the military who are looking into these deeper philosophy or philosophic arenas, mm-hmm. have they ever considered this holographic brain about an extension of their own professional lives? And, of course, I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, actually, I haven't read that book, but I mean, there are some fascinating ideas about consciousness and how it relates to the cosmos. And the ancient Greeks had some very interesting ideas. So definitely the Stoics thought that our consciousness is connected to the cosmos. They thought that actually they were kind of pantheists. They thought that consciousness is in all matter, and that it kind of, you know, so our consciousness connects us to other people and to the cosmos. So I talk a bit about that in my book. In terms of, I don't know about the kind of what the military know about that, but certainly this guy Edgar Mitchell, this astronaut who had been in the Air Force, he started up something called the Institute of Noetic Science. And I bet they have things to say about the holographic mind. So that might be a good place to look.
The discussion of consciousness, though, is a fascinating one in itself, and one that can almost make your brain hurt, because you're trying to think about why we think.
Yeah.
Essentially. And it sounds like some of the conclusions that people have drawn is, well, okay, it helps you to be able to avoid the things that can kill you. So it's a good survival thing. But it goes much beyond that in humans, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I find it fascinating too. I mean, is consciousness just functionalist? Is it just to help us survive and reproduce? To me, it seems surplus to requirements for that. I don't think you need to be as conscious as we are to. I mean, why do we really need philosophy? Why do we need to be able to ask these big questions about the meaning of life, and not just to kind of survive and reproduce, but even to kind of look back and say, well, why are we here? What's the point of life? Those kind of deep philosophical questions don't seem to me particularly helpful from an evolutionary perspective. They seem to point to something bigger than that, more than just kind of the desire to replicate our genes. But I don't know. I mean, I look at the philosophers I cover in the book. They have different theories about consciousness. So some of them, Epicurus, for example, thought consciousness was kind of a happy fluke. That we're in this atomistic universe where that we don't have any afterlife, and somehow or other we're just lucky enough to get consciousness and we can use that to live well. Whilst the Stoics were a bit more optimistic, they thought that consciousness in us points to some kind of relationship we have with the cosmos.
There is a whole lot to this book that we didn't even get to, and maybe we'll have you back at some point. Jules Evans is the author of Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations. Thank you so much for your time today.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me, Jeffrey.
You bet. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange, in our Events Day segment, we'll share storm stories and we'll pick up our discussion about cell phones on planes, because we didn't get into any comments on that last week. And then we'll talk to the author of Sharing is Good. Beth Baczynski will join us at 9 o'clock. That's all tomorrow on the Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Stay warm and have a great day.